From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Abderrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. Finally, and some American voters might well add mercifully, the presidential election debates are now over. The third encounter between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, was a rerun of its two predecessors. There was actually a bit more discussion of the issues this time, but eventually policy dialogue gave way to mutual finger-pointing, name-calling, and vitriol. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the long-awaited Allied assault against the ISIS stronghold of Mosul is underway, spearheaded by Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters aided by U.S. advisors. The Iraqi prime minister says the operation is proceeding faster than expected, but ISIS is showing signs of resiliency. Well, we have a lot to talk about here today, and Oren, I want to start with you. I have been covering presidential debates for 40 years, since the Ford-Carter debates of 1976, and I have to say these last three have been the most unpleasant, nastiest, and ultimately disheartening of them all. Maybe I'm too close to it, but how would you rate the debate? How did you see it?
I think that it depends on what you're rating exactly, and whether you're looking at them as entertainment or a horror show or political discourse. The debates have been, you know, I think some people who watched the Republican primary debates saw what was coming and figured that this general election season was going to be very unusual, and it has been. The vitriol and the bad vibes between the candidates was clear from the very beginning. They wouldn't even shake hands. Donald Trump was ripping up his notes at the end of the debate. He seemed so angry at how things worked out. You know, I think that Hillary Clinton's approach is to be very much, you know, she's a very good debater and she has a lot of experience at this. And Donald Trump is being Donald Trump, which is a relatively unscripted and unschooled debater.
What was interesting to me, Oren, was that, as I said earlier, the third debate seemed to be a rerun of the previous two debates. And here's what I mean. Donald Trump started out well for about the first 30 minutes. He seemed polished. He seemed scripted. He seemed, for him at least, relatively well-versed on the issues. And after about a half an hour, I was saying he's doing very well. But the same thing happened in this debate as the first two. Hillary Clinton got under his skin. She basically threw out some zingers, and he took the bait. It's clear that Mr. Trump has trouble with anybody beating him up. He has to beat back. There's a kind of a proportionate response, and if somebody hits him, he has to hit back. And to me, the most single worst soundbite was at one point after Clinton was needling him about Social Security taxes will go up unless Donald can figure out a way to how to get out of his. He just couldn't take it anymore, and he said, "What a nasty woman." And that's the kind of rhetoric you don't see in debates. As I said, for 40 years I've seen politicians call each other any manner of bad names, but I've never heard anybody say, "What a nasty woman," or "What a nasty guy." So I think that did not help him. But let's go to what is probably the biggest headline, and that was Trump being asked, would he accept the outcome of the election? Now, his vice presidential running mate, Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, has said, absolutely, we will accept the verdict of the American people. But when Trump was asked about that, he begged off. He said, I'll deal with it at the time. And when he was offered a chance to come back at it, he said, I'll keep you in suspense. Well, I remember turning to my wife and said, that will be the headline of this debate. And it turns out that I was correct about that. What is the big deal, Oren, about Trump refusing to accept the outcome of the election? And why did it seem to trigger such a negative reaction in the political world, even among some Republicans?
Well, because basically we have a very long tradition in this country, and it goes back 260 years or something like that of peaceful transitions in this country. And when he says that he may not accept the results of the election, he's questioning or putting at risk this long tradition. So Republicans have been upset by what he said. Obviously, Democrats have been upset by what he said. And, you know, he was saying that the election is rigged, and he has been saying this for a while. He's been saying that he's been urging people to go watch the polls and watch the vote counting process, which there already are people watching those polls, but it's illegal for people who are not certified and part of the process to be in those rooms because they don't want it to be, they don't want intimidation, and they don't want people to be taking ballots and moving things around when they're not supposed to. So there are concerns that he doesn't back down from this stance that he's taken of not willing to, that if he loses and he's not willing to accept it, that there could be some kind of disruption in the process.
Well, at the very least, we know that if Trump loses, the 36 to 38% of the electorate who will have voted for him at a minimum will be angry, and they will not be in the slightest willing to give Hillary Clinton, if she is elected, a mandate, much less political support. And that will complicate life for the country going forward. I think there's another problem for Trump with the refusing to accept the outcome of the election. And that is, it reminds people at the second debate, he said that he was going to name a special prosecutor to look into Hillary Clinton's missing emails, which we've talked about a lot on this program. And at one point after that, she said, well, I'm really glad that Donald Trump is not in charge of the legal system in our country. And he said, because you'd be in jail. The whole notion of putting political opponents in jail is something we've come to expect from banana republics, not the United States of America. Now, I don't think this would happen, but this is not what I would call a good talking point for Mr. Trump here. And so I think that was a problem also. As Orrin has said, we have a tradition in this country of not putting losers of elections in jail, not taking to the street, not endorsing in any way military coups. None of that is going to happen, but this is not conducive to enlightened discourse. Abdi, let me ask you how you rated the debate overall. How did you see it coming out?
It was obviously an extraordinary event in terms of showing the vulnerabilities of the electoral system now in the United States, probably things that Americans themselves have never thought about. But the reality of the situation is that now Donald Trump has awakened the appetite of those who think that the American system, electoral system, is rigged against them. And whether he wins against Hillary Clinton or he loses, that feeling is not going to go away. If anything, I can see it actually generating a debate. There are some legitimate concerns away from the banana republic concerns, as you call them. There are legitimate concerns by people who support Donald Trump, either because they truly believe he's the right guy for them or because they don't see an alternative to him. Those grievances have to do with the state of the economy. They have to do with the state of opportunities as they see them. We went to Youngstown, Ohio, and met some of those people, and they have real grievances. And when they explain to you why they cannot vote either Republican or Democrat, they are very convincing. Whether they are totally convincing when they argue that Donald Trump, for them, should be given a chance, even though now he's saying that if he loses, he's not sure if he would concede, basically taking the country, especially in the eyes of his critics, as close as it has ever been taken to the line of fire, is a different situation, obviously.
Another thing about the debate that struck me, Abdi, is the was the body language. You know, these days in debates, there's a split screen on the television where when one candidate is speaking, you see the reaction of the other candidate. And Trump's body language was dour. He scowled. Whatever else he was not a happy warrior. Witness is what a nasty woman comment that we've already discussed here. Hillary Clinton clearly was was scripted to smile and to laugh. She smiled a lot, she laughed a lot, and she did not get rattled. But the body language suggested two diametrically opposed visions and messages, one dark and angry, the other trying to say it's still a great country. Trump saying we're going to make America great again, Clinton saying we are a great country, we just need to be greater. Now, we'll have more in just a minute, but first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Tom DeFrank of National Journal. Joining me today are Abderrahim Fakhara of Al Jazeera and Oren Durrell of USA Today. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. All right, well, let's talk a little bit more about the debate, gentlemen. We haven't talked about the whole essence of these massive WikiLeaks that U.S. intelligence agencies have now publicly concluded, and the Obama administration has gone public on this, that the Russians are behind these attacks, implying that the Russians are interested in putting their thumb on the scale to tilt this election, if they can, to Donald Trump. Who has gotten the better of the exchange over Vladimir Putin? At the debate, Trump continued to say that we don't know who's behind these. Is that a credible position for him to take at this point?
I don't know for sure. I mean, I do find the whole situation a little puzzling, because the way things have panned out for Hillary Clinton ever since the news broke out that the Democratic Committee building had been hacked and her emails, or John Podesta's emails, had been basically hacked, things have moved in a way which is, I would imagine, positive for her, for Hillary Clinton, because it's made it very possible to say that Donald Trump is a puppet of Vladimir Putin, as that's the term she used herself in the last debate. But it also has to be said that when you look at how the administration has handled the issue, the White House issued a statement finally a few weeks ago, officially saying that the Russians were spying on the United States with the objective to actually undermine the credibility of the election. But we've heard from intelligence officials more recently. James Clapper, for example, a couple of days ago, he said that the Russians would not be able to tamper with the results of the election because the ballot boxes are not connected to the internet. That leaves me wondering, well, if the Russians cannot tamper with the ballot boxes, is there another way that they could meddle with the results of U.S. election? I'm not sure about that. And then that still needs to be clarified. And then the big question that basically rises, if the Russians are doing this, as the Obama administration official has officially now said that they are, then why have they been allowed to do this in the first place? And then what is the Obama administration going to do about it? And I suspect that we still have 3 weeks election battles for this issue to be basically hashed out.
Well, I don't think there's much at this point that the U.S. government can do about this, but Vice President Joe Biden has recently said, we have the capacity to retaliate, and we will do so at a time and place and method of our own choosing. And he was asked, are you going to tell us what you're doing? And he said, I hope not. So we will have to see. I'm sure at some point after the election, countermeasures will have been taken, and somebody, given the way this world works, somebody will leak some of that to the media. But Oren, back to you now. Who do you think has gotten the better of the whole Vladimir Putin exchange? I mean, Hillary Clinton has tried to say, and she said at the debate, that Trump is a puppet of Vladimir Putin, to which he said, no, you're the puppet, I'm no puppet.
Well, first of all, she listed a whole bunch of reasons to back up why she was saying that, and they include Donald Trump and his running mate, speaking of Vladimir Putin as a strong as a strong leader, as they have about other dictators or dictatorial leaders. He is talked at the debate about cooperating with Russia to fight the Islamic State rather than trying to counter Russia's growing influence in Syria. And she listed up other things. But, you know, I wanted to go back to this question about the emails and why do we think or why do the American intelligence services believe that they're connected to Russia? And the reason is that the software that was used to perform the hacks had Cyrillic alphabet in it, which is what the Russians use. The software is similar to software that was used in other incidents of hacking that was also tracked back to Russia. And the timing of the intrusions coincided with the work shifts in the Russian cyber office that is suspected of doing these hacks. So the evidence is actually pretty direct. You know, people who are questioning it say, well, that could be faked or that could be somehow fraudulent, but it makes the evidence much stronger that this is Russia. And the other issue is that the impact of this, I think when you talk about countermeasures, one of the questions has to be, what is the impact and what is the goal of these hacks and of what's happening? And part of the goal is to, appears to be, if not to to damage Hillary Clinton's campaign, than to damage the entire system, to undermine the confidence of the American people in their election system. I did a story, it's in today's paper, about the Russians tried to send observers to American polling places for this election, and had to be turned down because people aren't allowed into the polling stations, and they wanted actual access to the polling stations where the votes are being counted, and that's against the law in most places. So they ran an article in Izvestia, which was picked up by RT, that basically said that that they were threatened with arrest if they tried to observe American elections, and of course, I actually got the letters that responded to them to say that they can't come. And the letters, most of them were very genial. They said, look, we have a flood. One of them was in Louisiana. The guy said, the Secretary of State wrote that they have a flood. And a lot of they're very shorthanded, and they can't accommodate it at this time. But come by, and we'll show you how we do it and how we do the process. And they were very, very welcoming. And they said, come back in 2020 if you're still interested. We'll be happy to show you around.
Well, as the Duke of Wellington once said in an entirely different context, if you believe that, you'll believe anything.
Right. But the point is that they get the story, and it's a propaganda ploy, but they get this story out to that some people will see and will start to question their own process of how things work here.
Well, it's whatever else it is or isn't, it's a destabilizing situation here. But so now I want to save some time for what's happening on the ground in Iraq, but to close out this segment with a little more than 2 weeks left before the polls open. And actually, we should say that several million Americans have already voted through early, several states allow early voting, and millions of Americans have already voted. Where do you see the race? To put it in a little context, there's a fellow named Steve Schmidt, a highly regarded political consultant who was a senior official of both the George W. Bush campaign in 2004, and other Republican campaigns, and he says the race is over. He says Hillary Clinton has a minimum of 350 electoral votes. She only needs 266, I think, is the number, and that she might even go to 400, which would be a landslide of major proportions. Where do you see the race? Well, I should also say Trump's aides say that there's a hidden Trump vote out there, that you have millions of Americans who do not want to tell pollsters or reporters that they're going to vote for Trump, even though they're going to, and that the hidden Trump vote will propel him to a dramatic come-from-behind victory. Abdi, where do you see this race at the moment? I've always said, and have for quite some time, that it's Hillary Clinton's to lose, that she could, but she's not losing it at the moment.
Yes. I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, when you look at the calculus being mentioned by various people, it looks like Hillary Clinton is going to be the winner. But, these are American elections, and we are still 3 weeks away from the 8th of November. If I were living in Russia or somewhere else, I would have said yes. If a candidate 3 weeks away from election day, if he has or she has the calculus, fine. But in the United States, I would be a little bit more cautious because things could still happen that may change the calculus.
Oren, do you have a quick prognostication?
I don't make predictions.
Okay, it's probably safer that way. I will, however, make a prediction. I don't know that we know the winner, but I do think we know the loser, and the loser is going to be civility and probably any hopes for an end to the bipartisan gridlock that has hamstrung our governance for the last 8 years. And that is one prediction that I think I'm right about, but I must say I profoundly hope that I'm wrong. Now let's go quickly to Iraq. As we all know, the offensive against Mosul has begun by Iraqi soldiers, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and a fair number of American advisors and logistical personnel. Is victory for Iraq certain? I mean, the Iraqi prime minister has said it's going better than expected, and there's no question we're going to win. I think the American major general who's in charge of U.S. operations there has basically said the same thing. So is the question a victory, but how long will it take?
I think, and I don't mean to sound too philosophical about this, but I think it depends how you define victory. If you define victory as basically reducing the scope of the threat of the Islamic State, yes, then probably a lot of people are itching to call a victory, not just the Iraqis, the Americans, the Turks, the Iranians, many, many, many people are actually itching to call it a victory. But if you define victory in terms of what will actually happen in Iraq, even if the Islamic State were to be, let's say, in a theoretical situation, completely pulverized and destroyed, that still leaves the Iraqis with massive challenges, not just with regard to the situation as it has been unfolding since 2003, but in terms of the repercussions of defeating ISIS in Mosul in northern Iraq. What will it mean for Turkey in that part of Iraq? What will it mean for the Sunnis and the Shia? Especially, we've been hearing basically angry noise coming out of Ankara saying that the Shia, who are now clearly part of the fighting, cannot be allowed to be in Mosul post an ISIS defeat. So clearly very, very, very thorny questions will emerge for the Iraqis, even if ISIS were to be completely defeated there.
Even as Iraqi politicians are saying that the attack on Mosul is going well, ISIS launched a counterattack against the city of Kirkuk, killing 19 people. So there's still a lot of uncertainty here. Owen, briefly, what is your take?
Well, so I think that Islamic State will be pushed out of Mosul, and that there's an enormous, I think 30,000 strong force of Iraqi combined forces arrayed around the city and moving on it, and they have the support of American air power. So it's going to happen, but this Iraqi force is made up of a lot of Kurdish Peshmerga, Iraqi counterterrorism forces, Iraqi police, these self-mobilization forces, which are the Shia, Iranian-backed Shiite militias that Abdi's talking about, and Turkish-backed militias. And the Shiite militias have a history of extreme abuses against the local population. They've been talking about their hatred for the residents of Mosul for supposedly supporting Islamic State. So the aftermath of this is going to be long and messy.
To put it mildly, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Abderrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zaleski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Thanks for listening.